It's Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. This Tuesday, NASA's Cygnus mission lifted off from Florida, carrying cargo and science experiments bound for the International Space Station. And earlier today, it successfully docked at the ISS. And on this mission's cargo list, tomato plants. The tomatoes are part of an experiment from scientists at the University of New Mexico and UW-Madison. They hope to find out more about what helps plants grow in zero gravity and how we can feed the space explorers of the future. One of those researchers is with us now. Simon Gilroy is a professor of botany at UW-Madison. He leads the Gilroy Life Science Lab, which investigates how plants sense their environment and how that affects their development. Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, hello, Shereen.
Well, before we get into specifics, congratulations on the launch this week. What did you feel like when you watched your work shoot up into space?
Yeah, it's one of those experiences that we've seen multiple launches, and every time is absolutely amazing. I mean, just watching a rocket launch is amazing, but Watching a rocket launch that has your stuff on top of it is it's very difficult to describe to people who haven't seen it.
Oh, I can't imagine. When we think about growing plants, water, sunlight, nutrients, that all comes to mind. But it never occurred to me that gravity could be a key player in why plants grow the way they do here on Earth. Can you explain all of that?
Yeah. If you think about it, gravity is the great constant. It's everywhere. It's been unchanging for the whole history of life on Earth. So life has sort of grown up adapting to one times gravity, and it affects so many things that you don't even necessarily think about. So you can definitely go like, oh, well, we know up from down as human beings, and we can sense that direction. Plants can clearly do that as well. You know, classic thing, roots growing down, shoots growing up, that's sensing gravity. But it affects how water moves. It even affects how the air and the gases around plants move, and all of those things together sort of shape how biology operates.
How do you try to account for that lack of gravity and get the plant to grow in the right direction without that sense of up and down?
Yeah, because it feels like it shouldn't work, doesn't it?
It does.
I just always fall back at this point on biology is absolutely mind-blowingly amazing. And plants cope. I mean, astronauts cope with being in space, and plants cope with being in space. And it's that whole thing of, like, life will find a way. And so plants have to grow in a direction, right? So the roots are going to have to grow in one direction. The shoots are going to grow in another direction. And what they do is they key into something else. So plants are fantastically sensitive to their environment. And we provide them with lights. And so the gravity cue, which is sort of their basic background cue, disappears. But light is a very, very powerful cue for plants. And so the shoots grow towards the light and the roots grow away from the light.
Have you been able to kind of predict what you think will happen when it comes to getting them up there and growing them in space?
Yeah. Although biology is amazing and biology copes, space is a classically very alien environment. And biology has all of these great adaptations to living on the surface of the Earth with one times gravity. And when you move into space, it'll cope, but it is clearly not happy. And so we see that the plants grow a little bit slower and they switch on a lot of their defenses. So we see a lot of pigment production. And if you look at the genes which are being switched on, they switch on defense-related genes and stress-related genes. So our prediction is, we already kind of know this. This is not so much a prediction as we know what is going to occur, which is those plants are going to be slightly unhappy. They're going to grow, but they're not going to be growing optimally. And part of our experiment is a treatment with a fungus that we think will be able to sort of ameliorate a lot of that stress biology.
Yeah, explain a little bit about that fungus. I know it's important part of this experiment. What do you expect it to do?
Yeah, so biology very rarely works alone. And so plants don't work on their own just growing in the natural world. There's a lot of symbiotic interactions that occur. And so there's a naturally occurring fungus in the soil. It's got the great name of Trichoderma hazianum. And it's everywhere. It's like on your feet at the moment. It's, it's a naturally occurring fungus. And it interacts with plant roots. And when it first interacts with a plant, the plant just freaks out. And it sees a fungus and it thinks bad pathogen, and it switches on defenses and all the things you would imagine it would do to defend itself. But then over the course of a couple of days, you know, they come to an agreement, and it turns into a symbiosis where both plant and fungus benefit. And one of the things that the fungus does is it switches on inside the plant a lot of antioxidant production. And you know that whole thing, if you should eat fresh fruit and vegetables to have a high antioxidant diet, that is, that kind of chemistry is being switched on inside the plant. And antioxidants are one of the countermeasures that we think are going to be very useful for protecting you against what happens in space.
That's so fascinating. I have to know, though, why tomatoes? Why not cucumbers? Why not green beans? Why not carrots? I mean, what is it about tomatoes that made you think, yep, this is what we want to check out?
So, you know, there's a lot of background that goes into an experiment that goes into space. And there's been a lot of plant biology that has been done on the space station. And so we have flown a lot of different plants. We've flown cress, we've flown cotton. But NASA has also flown a lot of plants. And one of the ideas is that we want to understand what happens to plants that potentially in the future could be part of an astronaut diet. Maybe not sustaining the astronaut with everything they eat, but you have no idea how grateful they are when they get fresh food and vegetables that go up there. It's just,
I can only imagine, right? I mean, because how often can they get that?
Yeah, it's not every time that a resupply rocket goes up there, there's fresh food on it. But then, you know, months of the freeze-dried stuff that we all know from watching movies of astronauts. So a lot of what is grown in space is leafy greens, because one of the things you want to do is eat most of what you've grown. And so things like lettuce and cabbages and things like that, you do consume most of the plant. But who wants to live off lettuces and cabbages for their entire life?
No, thank you.
And so it turns out that tomatoes have lots of bonuses. They provide some variety into that fresh fruit and vegetable thing. And also, the tomato fruit has a lot of beneficial chemicals in it. For the astronauts, one of the things we want to give them is a lot of antioxidants. And tomato fruits are a fantastic way to do that.
How long have you been working on this project? I'm curious.
So there's a long, long lead time. This is about year five of setting everything up. So we've been doing about 4 years of prep work to get to the point of being able to put this thing on a rocket.
Well, besides getting the plants to the space station, what have been some of the challenges for you and your team over the last few years?
A lot of what space flight experimentation is you design the experiment, and then you have to take the step back and go, well, you know, we're not going to do the experiment. An astronaut is going to do the experiment. And they are absolutely amazing individuals, as you would expect. But they didn't design the experiment. They didn't work on the science behind it. So we spend a lot of that time, of that prep time, working out how to make the most robust experiment we can, and work out all of the challenges that we can expect that an astronaut would have, and then try and tweak the experiment in order to make it as simple and straightforward as possible, but also yield all of the experimental results we want. That turns out to be a challenge which takes a pretty large team of people with a lot of different expertise to think their way through.
Are there other vegetables? I know we talked about some of the other vegetables that are there, but are there other vegetables that you think you'd like to work with later as this kind of goes on?
So the bigger the diversity of sort of the crop plants which we can grow in space, the better. It's the classic thing of, especially if we're thinking about this as being a supplement to the diet, the more variety, the more likely it is that you're going to want to eat that kind of food. And one of the things that happens to the astronauts is, you know, it's a stressful place for the astronauts as well, and they kind of lose their appetite. So we've been thinking about a lot of different plants. The leafy greens are obviously going to be the sort of the focus for a long time, just because of that whole thing of eating most of them. Tomatoes, potatoes, sweet potatoes, all of the things that you like to eat. That's basically where we're going to be going.
We've got about 30 seconds left in our time together. I guess, what would success look like for this experiment to you?
Oh, I mean, of course, we're hoping that the tomato plants, which are inoculated with this fungus, grow into huge, bushy, healthy plants. If we saw that, we would be pretty happy.
Well, Simon, I want to thank you for sharing with us, and I hope this is all successful for you. It's fascinating.
Well, thank you.
Simon Gilroy is a professor of botany at UW-Madison and head of the Gilroy Life Science Lab. He talked with us about his research on growing tomato plants in space. His team's project arrived at the International Space Station earlier today. Coming up, we'll talk with an author about the lost art of hanging out with our friends and why she says we should do more of it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seewert. When was the last time you hung out with someone? When you just got together with a friend with no real plan or activity in mind, just to spend time together? For many of us, it's been a while. But why is that? Data show people are spending less time in person with their friends, and it's a trend that started even before the COVID-19 pandemic. Our next guest says that hanging out isn't just an activity for bored teens, and we should try doing more of it. Sheila Liming is an associate professor on the writing program at Champlain College. Her latest book is called Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. She talked with Central Time host Rob Ferret. Here's a listen.
You cover a lot of territory, different kinds of hanging out. Can you give a basic definition of the hanging out state of mind and activity?
Sure. In the book, I describe hanging out as basically the act of doing very little, but crucially, the act of doing it around other people. So it's that social dynamic that's really important for me. The fact that you are spending time with others, even if you're not really doing anything too constructive.
I mentioned my hanging out career declining over the last bunch of years, and I always kind of assumed it was just, you know, because I'm older now than I was, and that's part of it. But you write, you start off talking about this is a trend, and even younger people seem to be hanging out, yes, that less than younger people did. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm with you, Rob. I used to think that this was also sort of a me problem. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I think I started to consider it in a more systemic sense, that it wasn't just me, that there were also ways that we were being discouraged from hanging out, from spending time in each other's company, and also from having these kind of like open-ended experiences as opposed to highly structured experiences when it comes to those social interactions. So I started to think about it. And at the same time, because I'm a college professor, I was also thinking about it with regards to that population that I interact with, which is roughly 18 to 24-year-olds. And I was watching their habits hanging out and noticing this sort of decreased capacity for dealing with that kind of open-endedness or that free time, if you want to think of it, where there wasn't like a clear agenda in mind.
You use the word problem there. What do we lose when we don't hang out so much?
I think we lose a lot of things. And one of the things that I focus on discussing in the book a lot is the concept of stamina, that I think hanging out itself both requires stamina and also allows us to build stamina, the kind of stamina that we require for relationships, whether they're friendships or whether they're relationships with our family members or our coworkers or our neighbors or even strangers on the street. I think that stamina comes from, you know, repeated exposure, that the more we do something, the more we feel used to it, and also the more adept we feel at it. And the reverse is then also true, that if we're not practicing those acts, then we start to experience decreased stamina. And all of a sudden, when we find ourselves hanging out with a friend and it's kind of boring, or when we get into an argument with a family member, it feels like we just want to abandon the situation and walk away, as opposed to find a way to see it through.
You gave one great example, and I'm not just keying in on it because it happened to happen in Milwaukee over old fashions, but you talk about hanging out with a friend in Milwaukee over old fashions, and it wasn't great. It was, you were arguing about something, and you saw some real value to the fact that it was hanging out in person. Can you share that story?
Sure, yeah. So I open the conclusion to the book, which is called How to Hang Out, with a story about meeting up with a friend in Milwaukee. I was there for a conference. My friend, who I've known for many years, we met in college decades ago. He lives in Chicago, and I told him I was going to be in Milwaukee, and he took the train up to spend some time with me. And what's crucial about all of this is that, you know, he'd come up to see me, and then we were hanging out in this bar, a lovely little place in downtown Milwaukee called Stella's, and we were drinking old fashions, and we kind of got into this fight. And it was a big fight because we realized that we had a fundamental disagreement about our view of a particular social problem that we were both trying to dissect. And there was a moment where it felt like my friend was about to like get up and just leave the bar, but he didn't. And because he'd come all the way up on the train to see me, we ended up just sitting there in that bar for like 3 hours and like talking it out. And as we did that, what we realized is that we actually felt the exact same side or the exact same way about the issue we were debating. We just had different ideas about how we wanted to fix the issue or approach it. So there was actually more agreement than disagreement, but we had to sort of discover that for ourselves. And I often think how differently this interaction would have played out, say, if we were having it over text message or if we were having it over email or something like that. And maybe we would have just like stopped talking to each other, because that's very likely in those situations.
Talking to Sheila Liming about her latest book. It's called Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. You conclude the book with some, you don't quite call them rules or a manifesto, but some, I guess, guidelines to help encourage us. Before we get into those guidelines, though, just if somebody is thinking, yeah, I do miss hanging out, what's a first step? I don't think we could just show up and knock at somebody's door anymore. How do we get started in rebuilding our hangout stamina and mindset?
Well, I think one of the first steps comes with taking time. Mm-hmm. And that means basically that you have to find a way to prioritize time for hanging out with someone. And if you're a schedule-y person, that means that maybe you have to schedule that time. But, you know, what I try to emphasize in the book is the importance of scheduling that time without seeing like a clear ending point. Like, okay, we will spend exactly 45 minutes having coffee, and then we will go back to our jobs or something like that.
Take time is one of your recommendations. And then also, we were just talking about risks. Take risks is another one of your suggestions. How do we get back into that attitude of maybe it's not going to go well? Maybe it's not going to be perfect, but it's still worth trying.
Yeah. Risk is a big part of that feeling that comes from leaving the world of ease that we sometimes experience when we're in our homes to a more sort of precarious situation that happens when we try to exist socially around other people. So I think understanding that risk is part of the equation is an important place to begin. And then also understanding that that doesn't mean that it's always going to go swimmingly, and that's okay. There's going to be another chance. You can try again next time around.
Now, some of the obstacles to hanging out are individual choices. But clearly in the book, you talk about, you know, work sometimes creeps into our free time. There are a lot of, I guess, structural barriers to being able to just hang out with people. What are some of those, and how do we change them?
Yeah, I talk about the creeping dimensions of work for many of us, the way that our personal computers and our phones have basically extended the workday into what would have normally been seen as our leisure time or even our sleeping time or our family time or something like that. This sense that we're always accountable to someone or something else that doesn't physically exist where we are can pull us out of social situations and also make it harder for us to exist in those social situations in the first place. So that's certainly one of the concerns. But I also talk a lot about space and about the ability to exist inside common or shared space in the book, which is getting harder and harder. Sometimes it feels like our lives are increasingly more spatially isolated, and it's difficult to find ourselves in a spot where we can just interact with people, come and go, meet strangers, have conversations that maybe might not be the sort of things we would be expecting if we were having them just with people in our social bubble.
You spend a chapter talking about hanging out online. This is something I think about a lot. Hanging out online, no, I don't think it's as good as hanging out in person, but I've got friends in states around the country. We have, you know, Discord meetups and play games and things like that. Double-edged sword, what do you think about the value of hanging out with people online?
This is a time of year where I often think about how far flung my own social network is as I send holiday cards to people. And I just noticed that I just addressed holiday cards to people in 19 states. So I feel that feeling too, that my friends and my network and even my family members are really, really spread out. And of course, the internet has provided one means for me to try to fix that situation, or at least to try to make it a little bit more manageable, that I can talk to those people relatively easily, even when they're far away from me. And, you know, I do talk about how there are benefits to hanging out on the internet. For instance, in 2014, I moved to North Dakota, where I lived for 6 years, and I didn't know anybody there. And I started hanging out more and more on the internet to try to meet friends and to have people to talk to. But I don't think that that kind of hanging out is a replacement for the kind of hanging out that we have to do in our own communities, with the people who are right there in front of us.
I wanted to get into, you mentioned strangers a while ago, and I think a lot of us are shy about talking to strangers, but you say there can be a lot of value in that, that hangout, even if we're not going to make best friends with that stranger we meet. Leave us with some inspiration to strike up that conversation.
Right. Yeah. I had a wonderful interaction with a stranger this morning, actually, in a gas station, who just complimented me on my outfit. And then she was like, you know, I hope you find someone else in your day who you can compliment on their outfit and basically just pay this forward, you know, type of thing. But it was just kind of nice to talk to a random person like that, you know. And I talk about hanging out with strangers, which is a kind of daunting concept, but I think it all just begins with a conversation. Some sort of spoken acknowledgement where you see that that other person is there and that, you know, you maybe find a way to share a hello or something that shows them that you see that they exist there. I mean, that's the first small step. And then sometimes things grow from that. And especially if it's people who you see, you know, on a relatively daily basis or on an average basis, then sometimes those conversations can continue to grow over time.
Sheila, thanks a lot for hanging out with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm enjoying it.
Sheila Liming is the author of the book Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. We listened back to her conversation with Rob Ferret. A reminder, if you want to listen back to any conversations you hear on the show or share them with a friend, visit the newly redesigned WPR.org. And while you're there, you can see the latest from WPR News, listen to our podcasts, and much more. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Up next, a public health expert and a pediatric infectious disease doctor answer your questions about respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. But first, Wisconsin has seen an uptick in union activity in recent years. Cornell University data shows there's been 16 strikes and 30 labor protests in the state since the start of 2021. As Joe Schultz reports, labor leaders hope to cope, to carry that momentum into 2024 and beyond.
Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
On an October afternoon at UW-Oshkosh, dozens of people assembled outside to protest a university plan to cut roughly 200 positions. The rally was organized by United Faculty and Staff of Oshkosh, a union on campus. The union has effectively no collective bargaining power, but uses its First Amendment rights to try to make a difference.
That's how we can operate in this environment. All we want is to be at the table and to forge the next generation of what the UW system looks like.
That's political science professor David Seemers, the president of the union, speaking during an interview. Late last year, public sector unions filed a lawsuit challenging Act 10, the Wisconsin law that limited public unions' bargaining power. Unions hope it eventually reaches the state Supreme Court, where the law could be overturned. The lawsuit came as the state and country saw a flurry of union activity. The writers and actors strikes, as well as the National United Auto Workers strike, made international headlines. And plenty of private sector unions in Wisconsin also went on strike, from Teamsters at Line and Kugel's in Chippewa Falls to local UAW chapters standing in solidarity. New unions also formed, from beer vendors at Lambeau Field to journalists at Wisconsin Watch. That's as public opinion polling shows unions were overwhelmingly popular in 2023, with a 67% approval rating. Wisconsin AFL-CIO President Stephanie Bloomingdale says union activity in the state last year often translated to wins for workers.
We are seeing working people continue to come together to organize new workplaces in Wisconsin and also to participate in workplace actions when it comes to contract negotiations.
2023 also saw union membership in the state rebound slightly after hitting its lowest levels on record in 2022. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates the number of union members in the state increased from 187,000 in 2022 to 204,000 last year. While last year may have felt like a big moment for the labor movement, there was momentum leading up to it in the preceding years. That's according to Saba Wahid with the Labor Center at UCLA. She says the COVID-19 pandemic had a dramatic effect on the way workers viewed their jobs.
There was often profits on the company side, but then all this risk on the frontline worker side. We saw some massive shifts in the way that we were thinking about work, and especially the workers that sustain a lot of our cities and neighborhoods.
As pandemic precautions eased and the economy ramped up again, Wahid says the labor market tightened, shifting power to workers. In some cases, workers have used that power to call for higher wages or other changes. Mark Westfall is with the Fox Valley Area Labor Council.
For the first time in many, many years, workers actually have had the conditions more in their favor. Employers can't afford strikes, work stoppages.
Even so, labor leaders say more needs to be done to continue building on last year's momentum. They point to unionization efforts in the service industry as one way to do just that. Laura Dresser is with the left-leaning Cows Economic Think Tank at UW-Madison. She says unions played a key role in making manufacturing jobs safer and more lucrative for workers. She thinks the same could be done in the traditionally non-union service sector.
It doesn't have to be that your service sector jobs never provide benefits or have bad schedules that are unpredictable and mean that workers can't count on being able to pay their rent. This doesn't have to be that way.
Labor leaders say organizers still face big obstacles, but they hope the recent growth in union activity becomes a long-term trend. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, many places around the state are seeing an uptick in cases of respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. For many people, getting RSV is like having a common cold. But for some, including infants and people over the age of 60, RSV can cause serious illness and complications. In December, the Department of Health Services reported the first death of a child from RSV in Wisconsin this winter season. You may have noticed RSV making headlines again and wondered what exactly it is or why there's so much attention to it. Our next guests are here to help us understand the basics and find out what to do to keep ourselves, our families, and our communities safe this cold and flu and RSV season. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you in your family had RSV this season? What were your testing and treatment options? Do you have any questions about RSV for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Morgan Finke is a spokesperson for the Public Health Madison Dane County. Morgan, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Dr. James Conway is a professor of pediatrics at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health in the Divisions of Infectious Diseases and Global Pediatrics. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Shereen. Great to be back with you.
Dr. Conway, what exactly is RSV and how is it different from the common cold?
Yeah, great question. You know, RSV is a virus that we've known about for quite some time. Very seasonal virus that comes around in this area of the country, so usually November through March. And I think it was assigned to this sort of common cold misnomer, you know, because I think we didn't really think we had much we could do about it. And then we started to gradually learn more about it. And we've started to recognize that it's probably almost as bad as influenza for the general population. I think it has been largely tagged as being a problem for premature infants in most people's minds. And that was really the group that we were initially so focused on. But we've really learned a lot that, you know, there's about a million medical encounters a year from RSV, probably 80,000 pediatric hospitalizations. And it causes hospitalizations and deaths in adults at rates that are very similar to influenza. So I think we need to kind of put it into that bucket more than where we had it before in that common cold bucket.
Jim, what are the symptoms, basically?
Well, it starts out as a runny nose for most people, and you know, many of them are going to then develop, you know, a cough. A lot of these people that have had these sort of annoying coughs through this winter, many of them probably had RSV as the component to it. For the babies and for the older folks, though, it can progress to being a full-blown pneumonia where it gets down into the lungs. In the babies, it causes narrowing of their airways, and they get into a lot of trouble breathing and need oxygen and sometimes even need to be on a ventilator. Similarly, in the older individuals, it can really cause a lot of airway narrowing and then can secondarily lead to bacterial pneumonias, as bacteria have figured out how to take advantage of previously damaged lungs from these kind of viruses.
Jim, I also want to ask you about immune memory, because I'm wondering if this is something that's like chickenpox, where you get it once and then you really can't again, or is this something that your body just doesn't recognize and you can get it again and again?
Yeah, it can unfortunately happen over and over again for two reasons. One is that there's actually multiple strains of RSV, similar to the being multiple strains of influenza, and these viruses do change a little bit. But unfortunately, our immune systems aren't that great at remembering this one. And so this is one of the ones that people can get over and over again.
Morgan, RSV is pretty common. Kids and adults have been getting it for a long time. But why are we hearing so much about it in the news in the past couple of years especially? It just feels like we're hearing more.
Right. So I think, you know, one of the reasons, there's a couple schools of thought on that, but one of the reasons you might be hearing a bit more about RSV this year, and even, you know, last winter we saw more headlines around RSV. It's partially because of those increased precautions that we all took for COVID, you know, during those previous years. Things like social distancing also really worked to help prevent RSV infections. So some of those younger children might not have been exposed to RSV during that time and may be more susceptible now. We may be seeing more cases for that reason. Another reason that RSV is making headlines is there is a new vaccine available for the infection. So there's actually three different immunizations available, and that approval happened last year. So this is kind of our first respiratory virus season that the vaccine is available. And again, so that's another reason RSV is hitting the headlines a little bit more than we may have been hearing in previous respiratory virus seasons.
We heard the phrase triple-demic a lot in the last winter. Are we hearing that again this winter, or not so much?
So when you say something like a triple threat or a triple-demic, you're talking about, you know, we're seeing cases are high of flu, cases are high of COVID, and also of RSV. You know, when we start to see those viruses stacking up on each other, that's when we can kind of get concerned about that clinical setting and being overwhelmed in our healthcare system. So that's why it's, you know, it's important to use some of those basic prevention strategies. You know, no one wants to get sick. No one wants to get sick enough to end up needing to be hospitalized. And again, just kind of the idea that all of those respiratory viruses are happening during this winter timeframe, it's not a new concept. It's just the idea that, you know, we're kind of adding in this COVID and RSV in recent years, and we don't want to see our hospitals get overwhelmed with some of those patients. And of course, we don't want to see people getting sick either. So, I think we are seeing high levels of all three of them, and I wouldn't call it a triple-demic, but, you know, we've seen that level be pretty high over the last, just about the last couple of months. So definitely something we're keeping an eye on.
Jim, Morgan mentioned the new RSV vaccine. I'd like to ask you about that. It was rolled out last spring, I believe. What should we know about this vaccine and who is eligible to get it?
Yeah, as Morgan mentioned, there's sort of three different things happening all at the same time, which is why you're hearing a lot about it and why it's made things complicated. In no particular order, you know, one is for the young babies is a drug called nirsevimab, which goes by the trade name Beyfortus. And it's a one and done immunization that actually uses synthetic antibodies rather than forcing the immune system to make its own immunity. It actually provides pre-developed immunity. And it's for primarily the youngest kids, so kids under the age of 8 months during RSV season, as well as high-risk kids in their second season. So that was sort of one opportunity to really prevent much more disease, because we realized that, as I mentioned, you know, we used to think about it as a premature baby disease. And so there was a very expensive drug that you had to get every month to prevent that. This has now kind of made things a lot different because we realized that about half the kids getting admitted to the hospital were actually normal, healthy kids. So this has really changed the game for those kids. On the other end of the spectrum, then there's two vaccines that are now available, Arexvy and Abrysvo, both of that are approved for people over age 60, which is one of those groups that really is at higher risk for having complicated disease, same as influenza and COVID. And then the third group is actually pregnant women. So the other option to protect babies is actually to immunize mom during the latter part of the pregnancy, with only one of those is approved, the Abrysvo vaccine. But that then transfers immunity to babies. So that's a second way of protecting the babies, either give them nirsevimab or give mom a vaccine. So we've got all three of these programs all being ramped up at the same time this fall to get ready for RSV season. And as you can imagine, it's been quite a scramble in the primary care settings to try to manage all of this.
James Conway is a professor of pediatrics at UW-Madison, and Morgan Finke is a spokesperson for public health, Madison-Dane County. They're with us to talk about the respiratory virus RSV and what you can do to protect yourself and others from respiratory illnesses this winter season. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about this new RSV vaccine? Did you talk to your doctor about it for you, for your child, or an older adult in your family? And what questions do you have for our guests? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seewert in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about RSV with Morgan Finke from Public Health Madison-Dane County and Pediatrics and Infectious Disease Specialist James Conway from UW-Madison. You can weigh in, too, 800-642-1234. Has there been a lot of sickness going around in your community this cold and flu season? And what kinds of prevention measures are you taking to stay healthy yourself? Masking, vaccines? I mean, what do you want to know about RSV? This is your chance to call in. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Morgan, do you have a sense of how many people in your area are buying into the RSV vaccine?
One thing I should mention in terms of our vaccine distribution at public health is, you know, from a public health perspective, we are somewhat limited on who we can vaccinate for RSV. We have a limited supply of vaccine for infants and high-risk toddlers. And you can always call us to see if we're able to vaccinate your child. But anecdotally, I'll share that we've heard, you know, inventory issues being especially prevalent early on in the rollout of vaccines. And also some confusion and some issues involving, you know, insurance coverage serving as a little bit of a barrier in some cases for getting the vaccine. James might be able to speak a little bit more to the clinical side of what they're seeing, but that's our perspective from public health.
And Jim, I'll ask you, but Morgan, what kind of messaging have public health departments been doing around this? Has it been really on your radar?
You know, certainly we've been sharing information about, you know, just general health information about what RSV is, you know, what vaccines are available and the services that we at public health are able to provide. We do that through, you know, our website, blog posts, interviews like this one. And another thing our department does is collect and organize data about these viruses. So RSV is just one of the illnesses that we monitor on our dashboard, our respiratory illness dashboard. And it's kind of a high level bird's eye view of all of the things as it relates to respiratory viruses in Dane County. So we pull from a variety of sources of data, including hospitalizations, wastewater monitoring, and even some local research sources. And that dashboard is updated weekly. So if you would visit our website right now, you'd see that RSV has actually tipped back into a very high level. And if you'd zoom out and look at kind of the bigger picture trend, emergency room visits of people who are diagnosed with RSV is actually trending downward compared to the beginning of January. So again, all of that to be said, the dashboard is a great resource for the community to kind of keep tabs on where things stand. And also we kind of developed it after seeing the level of interest and demand from the community during COVID. People shared that they appreciated being able to kind of be knowledgeable and make proactive decisions about their health. So we wanted to carry that lesson forward in designing this dashboard. So that's one of the main ways that we communicate about RSV to our community is kind of through the lessons the data is showing us.
We have a phone call from Bethany with us from West Bend. Hi, Bethany. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What would you like to know?
Well, I've been experiencing symptoms, I think, that are very similar to what's on, you know, the websites I've looked at for RSV and have had other people that have had these similar symptoms. I think I'm more towards the tail end of a two-week cycle of this. I'm up to date on all my vaccines, except I did not get the RSV vaccine. At what point would it behoove me to do that, or is this now towards the end of the time frame that I would need to even do that?
Well, thanks for asking that question, Bethany. Doctor, what do you say about Bethany's question? Is it too late for her?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, we know this is a seasonal virus. We know we're only offering pregnant women vaccine September through the end of January. So we're actually done with that cohort. The babies are going to be getting nirsevimab through March. So, you know, that's kind of the seasonality of what we're looking for that group. For the older individuals, you know, it is worthwhile because, again, the protection is not universal after you've had an infection. And so, you know, it's still reasonable, although the risk goes down as we get into the warmer weather and spring months, that, you know, it should be gradually less risk, but it's never zero. You know, I think one of the things we learned through COVID was that we were offering testing for all these viruses year round. And it turns out that these viruses do kind of linger in the background and are around all the time. We just see these sort of surges in the typical November through March period. So, you know, certainly for high risk individuals over age 60, even if they've had RSV this season, I think it would still be reasonable to get it and give themselves some protection for the rest of the season.
Thanks for answering that. We only have a few minutes left, but I want to make sure we get as many calls in as possible. Let's go to Sheila now. Sheila is calling from Nina. Hi, Sheila. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. My question is, if you say you can keep getting RSV over and over again, what's the point of the vaccine? That's part one of my question. And the other is, I've asked two of my doctors now, I'm 71, if they think I should get it, and they don't seem to think it's necessary. What do you think about that?
Thanks, Sheila. Jim, what do you think?
Yeah, so really good question. So one of the things we haven't talked about is that, you know, as they identified this unmet need for this particular virus, this vaccine was brought forward on an accelerated review, which isn't quite what we did for COVID vaccines, were an emergency authorization. But it does basically mean that there's a lot of things that are still to be determined. And so one of the things that's still to be determined is whether this is going to be an annual vaccine like it is for flu, or whether you get it every 5 or 10 years like you do for Tdap and, you know, tetanus shots. That part is the part that's still not known. So one of the things we're still trying to sort out is how long is the immunity after you get the vaccine. The data we've got is, you know, just for the first couple of years, as these vaccines have been developed very recently. So that is a really good question, because that's the part that's still yet to be answered. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, some physicians haven't been pushing it wholeheartedly, is that they still want to sort of see how the rest of the information plays out to try to figure out really where do we position this. I think a lot of people think that ultimately we might get to a point where we have combined flu, COVID, RSV vaccines, for instance, and that you just get kind of a one and done vaccine every year. But that's still kind of stuff that's in development.
Yeah, thanks for answering that. Very briefly, let's go to Tom from Madison. Tom, we only have about 30 seconds, but very quickly, what is your question?
Yeah, I was wondering about Guillain-Barré and the RSV vaccine. My brother and his wife, or his wife has Guillain-Barré, and they don't want to get the RSV.
Okay, great, Tom. Is there a relationship, Jim? 30 seconds left.
Yeah, very, very rare cases, and certainly for certain populations. This is one of the reasons people really need to talk to their provider about their particular situation. And certainly as we're still sorting out details about these vaccines, if you've got an underlying medical condition that may, you know, be triggered by a vaccine, you know, that's something that would mean it's probably reasonable to pause.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jim. Appreciate it.
Always happy to be here, Shireen.
And Morgan, thank you as well. Appreciate you being here as well.
Yeah, lovely to be here.
Morgan Finke is a spokesperson for Public Health Madison-Dane County. James Conway is a professor of pediatrics at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health in the divisions of infectious disease and global pediatrics. They joined us for a look at the latest updates on vaccines and treatments for RSV or respiratory syncytial virus as cases continue to circulate around the state. Last weekend, I painted my bathroom a bright new color, and I love how it looks, but I'm going to tell you a secret. As a painter, I am a disaster. I have no patience for cutting in to make fine lines. I often wind up with at least a splotch or two on the ceiling and the floor when all is said and done. It drives my husband crazy, even though I go in afterward and correct my mistakes. I used to feel bad about it, like it was some kind of character flaw, but then I read a Reader's Digest story over the weekend that changed everything. Messy painters, it said. They aren't lazy. Apparently, we have the edge. Relaxed, flexible, and even more intelligent. Well, deep down, I know my messy paint gloves aren't actually sparking any genius or joy, but I'll take it anyway. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shireen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Now, as Americans, we often think of ourselves as some of the most privileged citizens in the world. But according to our next guest, the U.S. sits near the bottom of the pile when it comes to supporting parents and families compared to other wealthy nations. We'll talk with them about why U.S. parents struggle so much in our current system and what we can learn from other countries about improving conditions for raising a family. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What challenges do you encounter as a parent in the U.S.? What kind of support would make it easier on you and your family? Have you ever considered leaving the U.S. for the purpose of raising kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Stephanie Murray is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a former public policy researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She's also a graduate of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote a piece for The Atlantic about this issue, about why parents in the U.S. struggle more compared to other countries. Mm-hmm. Before we get into what's in the story, how did this first come to your attention, that parenting in the U.S. is different?
Yeah. Well, I guess the shortest answer to that is that I moved out of the U.S. I followed my husband for a job opportunity over to the United Kingdom at the end of 2019. And so I think that's probably where it all started. But if I had to trace it to a single point in time, I think it was actually, I had a conversation with a fellow parent and also a fellow expat, actually. He was from Australia early on when I was living over here in the United Kingdom. And we were just chatting, you know, I had my younger daughter with me. He had a little son with him, and we were just sort of, you know, comparing notes, right? And asking about, you know, where we had come from and all of that. And he was actually about to move back to Australia, and he could not wait. He was just like, I want to get out of the UK. I'm getting back to Australia, right? Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I was going to move back to the US, obviously. And I said, yeah, sure. You know, of course, that's the plan, right? And then he said, you know, yeah, my wife, she was offered a job She was offered a job in the U.S., you know, a little while back, and it would have been great for her career, but we figured it would be too dangerous for the kids. I think that there's just something about the way he said it, you know, sort of matter of fact, kind of like, yeah, you know, the U.S. kind of a dangerous place for kids, that really stuck with me and got the ball rolling, where I was sort of like, huh. You know, this is sort of how we look, you know, to other people.
Did he elaborate any more on that, or did it just kind of give you food for thought?
Just food for thought, because, I mean, we were kind of at a coffee shop and just kind of passing each other, right? We didn't have, like, time for an extended conversation, but it stuck with me, yeah.
Have you had other conversations with parents outside of the U.S. that have given you that same sense, that maybe have given you a look at the reputation that U.S. parents have, or, you know, the kind of the idea of what life is like here for children?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, American parents have a little bit of a reputation, certainly in Europe, for being kind of intense and hyper controlling, you know, not relaxed, you know, neurotic, maybe, I guess, sort of helicopter parenting, I think, is the way that we're
That was going through my head. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so so there's sort of that reputation that we've got. But then also, I think a lot of parents that I talk to over here, they're kind of flabbergasted by the conditions under which people parent. Just there are things that I should say they kind of take for granted over here that American parents can't. Right. So basic kind of like maternity leave, right? Sort of basic supports for working parents, that sort of thing. The absence of that, the fact that that's not guaranteed, that's sort of a baseline thing, I think, in Europe. That's just sort of taken for granted. Or health insurance, that's another one. That's not specifically family policy, but I do think it's on people's minds when they think like, huh, you know, if you lose your job in America, you lose your health insurance, and then what do you do if you have a kid who's sick, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's something that they just find very sort of befuddling. It's sort of like, well, how do you sort of parent under that kind of uncertainty?
Mm-hmm. What's it like there for parental leave? What, I mean, is there a mandate of parental leave there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. So, well, if you're talking about the UK, now, mm-hmm. to be clear, the United Kingdom, I don't think that I would not hold them up as a model of great family policy. I would not, mm-hmm. if there are any like U.S. policymakers listening, I would not. don't look at the UK. But they do have kind of the basics, right? They have pretty much a very broad-based job protection, you know, 39 weeks or so of leave, job protected leave that is paid. It's not very well paid. It's one of the worst paid programs in Europe, excuse me. But they've got that. They've got, they don't do so hot on childcare, right? But they have more of it than in America, right? A certain amount of subsidized hours that you can use as a working parent. And then there's also other kind of other stuff, you know, sort of direct cash support for parents, sick leave. That's sort of an important thing that parents need. What do you do when your child is sick, right? Those are not guaranteed in America at all. And they are much, the provision of that in the UK and certainly throughout the rest of Europe is much more generous.
Are there certain European countries that you think really do it well? I did see a Time magazine report that showed that suggested that the Netherlands consistently near the top, some of those northern European countries. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, well, there's a lot of different ways that you can structure family policy. I think the most comprehensive systems are in sort of the Nordic region, right? Sweden and Finland, Norway, the Netherlands is another good one. Actually, Germany has a pretty comprehensive set of supports. So, you know, the paid leave aspect, but then also childcare, also sort of direct cash supports. Those, you know, the most comprehensive systems have all of those things, if that makes sense. So, yeah, those are the countries that I think of as the most comprehensive, I guess.
We hear a lot here in the U.S. about a lack of child care. I mean, it's in the news a lot. People struggling to pay for it, people struggling to find it. So what do they do differently there compared to what we do here?
Yeah, you know what? That is an excellent question. It's probably more complicated than people think because it's not, you know, the U.S. does have some public provision of childcare, right? There are voucher systems that you can qualify for in that. But I think the thing is that they're sort of means tested and they don't reach a lot of people. I think that the big thing that makes a huge difference in countries that are really doing this right is that those systems are universal, right? Or far more access to them is far more broad based. So in America, if you are not fairly poor, right? Even then, it's certainly not a guarantee that you're going to get access to sort of free childcare or anything like that. But that would be your best shot. So for the average person, you know, you're really on your own entirely. You're just sort of at the whims of whatever the childcare market is. But in other countries in Europe, to an extent in the UK, although I don't think that they do this very well, but other countries, it's sort of universal, right? It's guaranteed that you are entitled to a spot in childcare or, for example, they do things kind of differently in different places, but I'll just give another example. In Finland, you can either have a spot in childcare after your paid parental leave is up, or if you'd prefer to stay at home with your child for a couple of years or pay somebody you know to watch them, they'll give you a home care allowance, right? And so that's not contingent on how much money you make or qualifying for it. It's just you are entitled to it because you have a child and they recognize that as sort of like a public good that children need, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about healthcare?
I mean, same thing. There's the whole notion of sort of, you know, we have public provision of healthcare for some people through Medicaid, right? That's also means tested. But then certainly here in the UK and I think throughout most of Europe, you just get healthcare, right? It's not something you don't have to think about. It's kind of interesting. I wish I could sort of like put people in my position, because I do think that it sort of really impacts the way that you parent. I'll just give a quick example. One time my daughter got really sick and it was really scary. And we called the doctor and she had me take her temperature and blah, blah, blah. And basically she instructed me to go to A&E, or that's what they call the emergency room here. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing that, and just as an American, like my impulse, everything in me was just like, wait, like, sorry. I didn't even know what question to ask. I was just nervous. I was like, I do everything to avoid going to the emergency room. Which emergency room? Is it going to be in network, right? Am I going to, you got to give me more specifics, because you can't just tell me to go to the emergency room because I'm going to get like saddled with some kind of huge bill. You know, I was just very nervous. Like, can I go to an urgent care or something like that? Mm-hmm. And so I think I sort of like mumbled something like, you know, okay, which A&E, which emergency room? And she just kind of like clacked on her computer and was like, I mean, just the closest one, go to the closest one, right? Mm-hmm. It looks like, you know, BRI, right? In Bristol is, you know, go there, right? And I just remember thinking, like, there's something very liberating about that, you know, being given permission to just sort of like run with your child, your sick child, to the hospital without worrying about, oh my gosh, am I going to the right one? Am I going to be able to pay for this? Am I going to be able to prove that I should be able to get this care, you know? And so, yeah, I think there's almost an emotional quality to the way that kind of like broad and guaranteed access to that kind of support can really change how you parent.
And it sounds like really it took a lot of stress out of you, stress from you and stress and worry when you want to be worried about your child and not about mm-hmm. the cost.
Yeah. And I think that feeling that, that's woven into, it's absent in a lot of American life, and it's woven into life here in big ways and small ways. And it's very reassuring. So I guess the way I would sum that up is I think that, you know, in America, generally speaking, you know, we treat children as a personal matter, right? They're not, from a public policy standpoint, we don't really think that it's the government has an obligation to sort of help you raise your kids. The ideal is for you to be able to do that, right? And so we don't really step in with help unless something's gone wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And even there, right, we do it in this really stingy fashion where we're, you know, it's hard to access programs and they're designed, you know, to be temporary. The goal is for you not to need help with childcare, government help with raising your child. But then that's really not how it works in other countries. And I guess I would say it's almost like the way policy sort of thinks and considers the needs of children and parents much more often throughout the whole policy system. There are just more guarantees, right? And I don't know. It's not just the family policy. It's not just the health insurance. It's little things that you kind of see, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you one more example. During COVID, you know, schools shut down for a while, of course, in the U.S. and in Europe, right? Mm-hmm. But in the U.K., they never actually entirely shut down. Actually, this was true for a lot of Europe. They didn't actually entirely shut down. They always kept them open for essential workers and for, like, vulnerable kids who sort of a certain category of children who maybe didn't have a great home life, right? And I remember learning that. You know, that's certainly not how it worked in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I remember learning that in the U.K. and sort of feeling like, huh, you know, there's something kind of interesting about that. They are not taking parents for granted, right? They are thinking about the needs of children. They're not assuming that the parents are going to be there, that they can just shut down schools and the parents will be there, right? They weren't making that assumption, right? We can argue mm-hmm. all day about what was right or wrong with school closures during COVID. That's sure. not my point. But just the way that they were thinking about children, they were thinking about them. They were not taking parents for granted. And I think that's kind of the theme, right? That, mm-hmm. you know, when you...
Kind of the message that you took away from that. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think we do take parents for granted in America from a policy standpoint. And that produces a real precarity, I think, for the whole parenting experience.
We need to take a quick break. We're with Stephanie Murray, contributing writer at The Atlantic and a former public policy researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, talking with her about why parenting is harder in the U.S. than in other countries. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Is there anything you think the U.S. does particularly well in supporting parents and families? Or have conditions in the U.S. affected your decision of whether or not to have kids? The number to call is 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. As we continue our conversation with Stephanie Murray, contributing writer at The Atlantic and a former public policy researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, we're talking about why parenting in the U.S. is especially difficult compared to some other wealthy countries. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Stephanie, I want to circle back to something that you mentioned earlier in our conversation. You were talking about a conversation that you had with a guy who thought it wasn't safe to raise kids in the U.S. How safe is it to raise kids in the U.S., and where do those fears come from?
Yeah, wow. How safe is it? Well, okay. I feel like I don't want to, like, scare anyone, because I think that, you know, children dying, right, is rare in rich countries across the board.
Yes.
But kids do die at about, you know, there was one analysis that looked at, you know, how likely are children to die in the U.S. compared to other sort of a set of comparable countries. And they're almost twice as likely to die before, you know, they turn 18. So children do die at higher rates in America in general. And then a lot of that is a huge, the biggest contributor to that for the past couple of years has been gun violence. It accounts for 20% of child deaths. And, you know, that's enormous compared to other countries. You know, I think on average, you know, again, if we're comparing it to sort of this set of comparable countries, it's less than 2%. In the UK, it's, I mean, almost no children die of gun violence. It's pretty much not a thing.
How do all these factors contribute to how it feels to be a parent in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think, that's a good question. So I think, you know, we talked a bit about family policy and sort of the broader social safety net, right? You know, we don't help people kind of keep working and have a child, right? But then we also don't have much of a social safety net in general, right? For anybody, you know, if you lose your job, we've got a stingy social safety net. And then we've got policy more broadly that I think doesn't really consider children so much, very much, like the notion that you should, you know, have to give up your gun in order to make sure that kids can, you know, roam free or whatever it is, isn't something that makes a lot of sense to American policymakers. That's not how we think about public policy. And I think that when you take all of those things together, what ends up happening is it produces a real sense that no one, that your child's welfare is all on you, right? And I think that, you know, it affects, I think, parenting in a couple of ways, right? It on the one hand, I think it makes it scary for you as a parent, right? Unless you have a lot of resources from family or just, you know, two very high incomes or something like that. It can be scary, right, to be so close to, you know, losing your job and then having very far to fall if you actually lose work, right? That in and of itself can, I think, make the whole thing more stressful. But then on top of that, you know, it changes your responsibility as a parent, right? Because what is your goal as a parent in America is to, you know, you need to raise a kid who's capable of surviving without a safety net, right? And so I think that it's almost like parents get hit twice by the stinginess of our public supports, because it makes it tough to parent, but then it also sort of raises the stakes of parenting itself. I think it really encourages a kind of the meddling approach to parenthood that we're sort of famous for, the, you know, obsessed with academics and all of that. You know, there's a case to be made, and people have made it. There's an economist who wrote a book about this, that, you know, the economic conditions really shape, you know, what parenting is like. And so I think, you know, we have a highly unequal society. We have a lot of, you know, people really fall through the cracks in our, or the gaping holes really in our social safety net. And I think, yeah, I think that changes what parents have signed up for.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, for joining us today and talking about this important subject.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Stephanie Murray is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a former public policy researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We talked with her about the unique challenges of raising a family in the United States and what we can learn from other countries to make parenting easier. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, why is the rent so high? Rent prices have skyrocketed in recent years. We hear from a Wisconsin housing expert on the factors that led to the rise and what to expect in the future. And tomorrow is Food Friday. A cookbook author shares how to create satisfying meals in just 15 minutes. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.